supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Manayunk grad student Philip Garcia had a moment of fame this week when the Washington publication The Hill ran a story about how Garcia won a Philadelphia election with just one vote. The position was for a local election board, and WHYY's Dave Davies reports that city officials wish more people were willing to do the same thing.
A tweet about Philip Garcia's one-vote victory to become election judge at a Philadelphia polling place got 58,000 favorites on social media. But to city election officials, it wasn't such a novelty.
It's actually quite common. We had 71 judges of elections win through one write-in vote.
That's Al Schmidt, who co-chairs the Philadelphia City Commission, which runs elections. Every 4 years, Pennsylvania voters cast ballots for three members of their local election board, those folks who sit at card tables and run our elections in each precinct. That's 1,686 elections just in Philadelphia. Besides the 71 single-vote election judges, there were more than 30 ties for election board posts, nearly all among candidates who had just one vote each. Ties were resolved yesterday at a commissioner's meeting by drawing numbered tokens from a coffee can. Candidates who showed up, including Jesse Breitbart, could pluck their own.
So I put my hand in and pick out one ball, right?
That's all.
Yeah. I picked a one.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It is an honor to be a minority.
He doesn't mean a racial minority. Breitbart won the post of minority inspector for his polling place in West Philadelphia. When candidates run for election inspector, the top vote getter becomes majority inspector, and the runner-up, the minority inspector. It's intended to ensure two different parties are represented, but in some Philadelphia precincts, Republicans are scarce, and the board can be all Democrats. Schmidt says all of the posts can be hard to fill, including that of election judge.
We have still, after that election, about 500 of those positions where nobody ran for judge of elections.
You get that? For 500 precincts, nearly one out of three, nobody ran for election judge, not even a write-in. Schmidt says this also is not unusual. Election board members have to attend training sessions, then work 14 hours on election day for $100 before taxes. So it can be hard to recruit people, hard to keep them. There are two ways to fill empty election board posts. With the signature of three voters from your precinct, you can get a court order to occupy one of them. Or, Schmidt says, there's another way.
The election code in Pennsylvania provides for something called a curbside election. That means that the people who assemble at that polling place at the time the polling place is opened organize themselves, and they have a vote amongst themselves to determine who's going to do what on election day.
It sounds stranger than it is. What really happens is that people in the community, some recruited by the city commissioner's staff, trade phone calls and agree to volunteer to show up for election day duty. Somehow, it mostly works. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Archaeologists in Delaware have discovered 11 sets of human remains dating back to the late 1600s. WHYY's Zoe Reed reports that the find is attracting top-level experts.
The remains of three individuals of African descent and eight individuals of European descent were discovered at Avery's Rest. That's a 17th-century plantation in West Rehoboth, first unearthed in the 1970s. It was originally owned by John Avery, who served as a judge in Lewis after the colony transitioned from Dutch to English rule. Daniel Griffith and his all-volunteer team at the Archaeological Society of Delaware found the first burial in 2012 while trying to investigate what households looked like in the 17th century.
Trying to find house, wells, and fence lines, where they have gardens and things like that. As it turned out, in the process of doing test excavations to track down one of the fence lines we found, we ran into a burial. We went, uh-oh, this was totally an accident. And that's why it's called an unmarked burial. It's unmarked, and there's no archival record that there's burials on that location.
Experts in the field are using a new, more sophisticated version of DNA testing to try to determine who the individuals were. Dr. Douglas Owsley of the Smithsonian Institution is leading those efforts. He says these are the first discovered burials from this time period in Delaware to be so well preserved.
This is so rare of discovery in terms of the preservation, in terms of the background information. You're really dealing with frontier Delaware. These are the first wave of English settlers coming into Delaware. And then on top of that, you have really among the first Africans that are coming in too, being brought in. But at this time period, 1680, at that time, there's probably only about 50, certainly less than 200, but probably only about 50 Africans in the entire Delaware area.
Owsley says technology has improved so much that just 10 years ago, they would not have been able to learn as much from the teeth and bones as they are now. From the Delaware Desk, Zoe Reed, WHYY News.
When Phil Murphy takes office as New Jersey's next governor on January 16th, his initial course of action will be informed in part by priorities drawn from the People's Agenda, based on the Voting Bloc Project. Joe Amditas, Associate Director of the Center for Cooperative Media at Montclair State University, is one of the Voting Bloc Project coordinating partners and joins me to review the recommendations. Joe, thanks for being here on NewsWorks Tonight.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
First, describe the Voting Bloc Project.
Well, for the past several months, 28 different news organizations across New Jersey banded together to report on the governor's race through the lens of local neighborhoods. We called it the Voting Bloc Project, sort of a play on block and block. And the plan was sort of simple at first, just gather neighbors together, get them to talk politics, break bread, and then have our partners report on what they discussed. So in the end, we ended up getting together well over 100 neighbors in various cities and towns across New Jersey to produce around 70 or so stories about and from those communities. And then at in the later point, we opened up, we used GroundSource, which is a text messaging platform that allows you to engage with audiences via text. And we solicited nearly 400 responses that all outlined the top priorities that each resident or respondent felt was something important that governor-elect should address.
Let's note that of the aforementioned 28 news organizations, it includes us, WHYY, NJ Spotlight, among others. And then once those stories were collected, what was the editing process by which the project came up with? It seems to be 10 broad categories in terms of prioritization.
This was a fantastic effort on behalf of CIR Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, going through all of this data and all of this, these text messages and responses that we received, cleaning that data, making sure that it was legible. We can look through it. They organized it for us. And they identified a series of topics that range from immigration, minimum wage, taxes and affordability to legalization of marijuana, infrastructure, improvements, transportation safety, even gun control, and net neutrality even came up a few times.
No surprise that the economy and specifically property taxes, by far the biggest issue with voters. Were there surprises, though, along the way?
I think New Jersey, really, I mean, when they're more nuanced than you would think. You know, a lot of folks, and a lot of times when we hear about these kinds of political discussions, they can get rapidly partisan and sort of they lose their gray area. People seem to take one extreme or the other, or you would assume that. And in a lot of cases, I just didn't see as much as I expected. I mean, there were folks who acknowledged that the cost of living goes up and is continuing to go up and that taxes are very high, but at the same time are more than willing, in some cases, to foot that bill if it means that their children and the children of their community will get a good education. It wasn't as black and white, red and blue, you know, left and right as many may tend to assume.
And so what is the next business of the Voting Bloc Project with regard to the People's Agenda?
So we've drafted a letter to Governor-elect Murphy, which we will deliver to him and his administration, which includes a pretty decent summation of the major issues and items that were identified by voters and respondents to our text messaging campaign, with additional links and resources for him to, you know, dive down and really see and get into the weeds and understand exactly what these folks are calling for from his administration and hope to see out of him and his folks. But the next step for us is to obviously continue to solicit input and to continue to engage with the communities that are part of this project and otherwise outside of these specific ones that we chose. and then deliver that letter to him and his administration and continue to remind him, follow up, and make sure. I think the next time we're going to be following up, a hard hit time, is the spring. We'll be circling back around and trying to evaluate the impact of that agenda and sort of do a scorecard of sorts to figure out exactly what steps have been taken, what kind of progress has been made, and we'll move forward from there depending on the results of that evaluation.
Listeners can certainly find a link on our website, whyy.org/news, to the Voting Bloc Project's People's Agenda. Joe, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Joe Amditis is Associate Director of the Center for Cooperative Media at Montclair State University. It's one of the Voting Bloc Project coordinating partners. And again, to note that WHYY and NJ Spotlight are among the 28 news organizations who participated as well. Research out of Villanova University is shedding new light on what's known about life after prison in the long term. WHYY's Aaron Moselle reports.
Villanova professor Brianna Remster wanted to know what happens to state inmates several years after they're released from prison. Using homelessness as a barometer for their quality of life, she looked at the experiences of more than 10,000 men for nearly a decade after they got out. Two important things emerged. First, Remster found that nearly 10% of the men in her sample ended up staying at a homeless shelter, often years after they were released and often more than once.
Living in a homeless shelter repeatedly for months at a time is strong evidence that some people never reintegrate, at least not in almost 8 years after release. Instead, I find evidence of essentially a vicious cycle. Individuals become homeless, get back on their feet, and within a year, they begin the process over again.
Remster also found that nearly all of the men, more than 90%, had never been homeless before being in prison. That's what happened to Robert Rice, who was first locked up when he was just 11 years old.
I spent 27 years in institutions in total, from juvenile to adult.
Until about a decade ago, Rice, who was not part of Remster's study, always had a place to stay when he was released from prison, usually his parents' house in West Philly. That changed after he spent nearly a decade behind bars for aggravated assault.
8.5 years took a toll on most of the people I knew, so I came in, and then for some of the people that I knew for a long time, it was like it's hard to invite a stranger into your house.
For the first time in his life, Rice was truly homeless. He went to a shelter and stayed for about a month. It wouldn't be the last time. The 51-year-old is now 4 months into his third stay at Sunday Breakfast Rescue Mission, the same shelter that took him in all those years ago. Looking back, Rice says being defensive and impatient cost him jobs and a life that would have protected him from becoming homeless again. He says both of those traits were cemented in prison.
I need to see a solution now. I can't wait on nobody. I can't wait on the law. Can't wait on God. I need to make a snap decision right now. And a lot of times it's detrimental to your well-being.
Professor Ruben Miller studies the lives of former inmates at the University of Chicago. He says Remster's study is unique because of how many years of data she looked at. Most reentry research only covers the 2 or 3 years immediately following release.
It has real implications for how state and local governments fund housing and supportive housing services. It has real implications for how foundations think about directing resources toward programs and what types of programs they should direct resources toward. And finally, it has real implications for us, the American public, who have an ethical question that we have to address. Okay, we have the kind of society that renders people homeless. Is this the kind of society that we want?
Remster says this isn't just a question for Philadelphia, but the country. Nationally, more than 600,000 people get out of prison each year. Aaron Moselle, WHYY News.
The open enrollment period for purchasing insurance through the Affordable Care Act marketplace ends next Friday. Last year, nearly 80% of Pennsylvania consumers selected Silver plans, a middle-of-the-road pick that people tend to choose if they're relatively healthy. Premiums across the board continue to rise, but this year, costs for those Silver plans in particular have skyrocketed. From Pittsburgh, 90.5 WESA's Sarah Bowden reports that this presents consumers with a unique set of options.
Ali Shapiro and Carlos Quiros, a couple in their late 30s, live on the edge of Shadyside and Larimer.
Type of work? Wellness? How much net income from this month?
While sitting at their vintage Formica kitchen table, they scroll through healthcare.gov looking at insurance options for 2018.
Okay, so we have a bronze at $575 per month for both of us.
Silver and gold, yeah.
Yeah, the gold is less.
That's interesting. Why would it be less?
The premium for a gold plan looks to be about $20 less than silver, even though it's more generous. Quiros is overdue for a colonoscopy, and the couple's hoping to have a baby next year, so they're happy to sign up for gold.
We gotta get a baby in.
It'll be our gold baby. Yeah, it'll be like our gold year baby. We'll always remember it as... Remember, that was the year we had the gold plan?
This peculiar pricing is due to something called silver loading. In October, President Trump decided to end payments to insurance companies on the Obamacare exchange. The federal government had paid cost-sharing subsidies to insurers to offset the expense for silver plans they're legally obligated to sell to low-income people. These special silver plans have lower deductibles and co-pays. But now, insurance companies are on the hook to sell these cheap plans without the subsidies. To compensate for the loss, companies hiked up the cost of silver plans. This hurts some people, but benefits others.
We were totally surprised because we expected it initially to be even higher than our $145 that we're currently paying. So we were totally shocked.
Kim Jedlowski of New Kensington, a retired accounting clerk, is also switching from a silver to a gold next year because gold's cheaper. What's even more surprising is that Jedlowski's costs are dropping from $145 a month this year to $87 a month next year. The reason? Jedlowski receives a tax credit, which covers a large portion of her premium, and that credit has increased.
My tax credit this year is $692.
Each month?
Each month. And last year, it was $526.67, so the tax credit went up as well.
So there's your savings right there.
Right there. That's my savings.
Jedlowski's savings is also tied to silver loading. Her tax credit is based on her income and the price of silver plans, regardless of which plan she selects. When insurers balloon silver premiums to compensate for the lack of cost-sharing subsidies, it triggered an increase in tax credits to low-income consumers. But only individuals who make less than about $48,000 a year qualify for those tax credits.
Oh, nice to meet you. Thanks for doing this.
Not at all.
Jason Miller of Bairdford is an accountant for a small real estate company. He's 30, healthy, tries to stay active by spending time outdoors and taking his dogs, Evie and Penny, for walks.
Yeah, when it's just me and Penny, we'll do a little bit of a jog, but Evie's a little old to be jogging, I think.
Miller earns just a little bit too much to receive a tax credit. If he were sticking with a silver plan, next year he'd pay about $100 more per month. To contain costs, Miller plans to buy a bronze plan with a much higher deductible.
I don't know. I just feel like the wrong person's footing the bill, I guess.
Do you feel like you're footing the bill?
Yeah, in a way. Yeah, definitely.
In fact, he's so annoyed by the situation, Miller says he's buying his insurance off exchange as a sort of protest. There's some bipartisan support in Congress to pass legislation reinstating subsidies to insurance companies. But with rates already set for 2018 and the enrollment deadline quickly approaching, such a move will likely have little effect on what consumers pay next year. I'm Sarah Bowden in Pittsburgh.
The prolific Philadelphia playwright Bruce Graham's new offering is The Craftsman. It's a story about a Dutch painter arrested for treason as a Nazi collaborator just after World War II. The production in Center City by Lantern Theater Company has been a hit and has been extended. For WHYY, Howard Shapiro offers this review.
The Craftsman, in Lantern Theatre's seamless world premiere production, is a play the stage company commissioned. It's a knockout, with no questionable plot twists and no coincidences to buy into. It's also proof that real life can be at least as strange as fiction. The Craftsman is a true story told with Graham's flourishes that turn the tale into riveting theatre. It's about a Dutch painter who became an art dealer and sold a prized work to Hermann Göring, Hitler's field marshal. That artwork had been authenticated by Dutch experts as a painting by the revered artist Jan Vermeer, and the dealer was accused of selling a national treasure to the Nazis. The leading Dutch art critic of the day, a snooty man named Abraham Bradius, figured in both the authentication and later the trial of the dealer. In Graham's play, the young artist who's not yet a dealer confronts Bradius after a bad review.
This review may have ruined my career. Do you take no responsibility for that?
I'm sorry you feel that way, but I stand by my review, sir.
No, you're not. You're not sorry. It's fun to write a bad review, isn't it? Gives you a chance to show off your wit.
Believe whatever you like.
It's not fun to write a bad review, but whatever the case, Graham uses this argument through the play as the artist's motivation to somehow get back at the critic. You can call this a revenge play. Several of the characters want it, almost as a form of redemption for the way the war changed them. That is particularly true of the prosecutor, a character meticulously performed by Ian Merrill Peaks, who comes to realize that his sudden power in the post-war government is not really a blessing, and that the art dealer he's demonized has his own scars. The dealer is played by Anthony Lawton, the critic is Paul L. Nolan, and Dan Hodge plays a lawyer whose reverence for the law trumps the national thirst for getting even. The ensemble acting is terrific, and the audience feels like the jury in the courtroom scenes. The Craftsman runs through December 17th. For WHYY, I'm Howard Shapiro.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. On Saturday, the Army-Navy football game returns to Philadelphia for an extended stay. We'll have a preview of the matchup on tomorrow's show. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.